and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Monica Attard. A week is a long time in politics, as they say, and even during lockdown, New South Wales showed just how true that old chestnut is. In the space of a few days, New South Wales went from having Gladys Berejiklian riding high in the polls and on her way to leading her state out of lockdown to the swearing-in of a new Premier and Deputy Premier. Add to that multiple by-elections and general confusion. We all know why it happened, but in this edition, we need to ask, did the media play its part in informing the public and holding the powerful to account? And why the level of grief at the fall of yet another New South Wales Premier, this time to a corruption inquiry? To help us this week, we're joined by Lucy Cormack, who reports New South Wales politics for the Sydney Morning Herald, and Troy Bramston, who's a senior writer and columnist for the Australian newspaper. Lucy Cormack and Troy Bramston, welcome to Fourth Estate. Thank you both very much for being here. Now, a lot of people, and not just in New South Wales, were shocked, blindsided. They were even angry that Gladys Berejiklian resigned from politics altogether after ICAC's announcement that it would investigate her after evidence given to an inquiry last year. I imagine both of you were surprised, but perhaps not shocked that she resigned. Let's just go over why in the end do you think, not just in terms of the inquiry being announced, but why in the end did she go? And did she have any real alternative? Lucy, we might start with you on this one.
Yeah, so look, I think one thing that's become clear, of course, is that this was a huge shock for the public. But perhaps, if you had been sort of paying attention or in sort of following the course of the ICAC investigation and in political circles, it perhaps wasn't as much of a surprise. We knew that investigations were continuing. We knew that the ICAC had delayed its findings on the Darra Maguire, as we had expected to receive those earlier, and they delayed those and pushed those out. So there was sort of this kind of sense of foreboding as, well, something still was to come. And I think that the fact that she's ultimately stood down, I mean, I'm of the view that I don't really see any other way around it. It's the standard that she'd set for every other Premier. I mean, some would argue she should have stood down perhaps sooner, but indeed, I think given the very serious allegations that have been levelled against her, whether or not she has led us through a pandemic well and led the state, in a way that's seen us sort of succeed through the pandemic, that's sort of irrelevant, I think, when it comes to the fact that these are serious allegations being levelled against her by the corruption watchdog, and she has to respond to that.
So, I mean, in a sense, do you think, because there wasn't an awful lot of reporting at the height of, Delta, for example, in particular when Delta kind of hit New South Wales in a big way, that there wasn't a lot of reporting of what was going on in the background with ICAC. Obviously, you as political reporters and Troy, you as a commentator, you would have been aware of what was going on. But what, and that obviously has come as a surprise to the public, but do you think that's contributed to the level of shock that we've seen, Troy?
Yeah, Monica, I think it definitely has. There's no doubt, facing a 1-in-100-year pandemic has focused the public's attention, and it's probably drained some media resources away from keeping a spotlight on what was going on at ICAC. But I actually think that what happened at ICAC last October, when the Darra Maguire relationship with Gladys Berejiklian was revealed, I thought they were sufficient grounds for her resignation, and we might be able to talk about some of the aspects of the ICAC Act and what actually took place then, which led me to take that view. So I was not surprised at all with her resignation. I was only surprised that it took so long. And, of course, that inquiry, which is called Operation Keppel, has now been extended into new areas. So the inquiry is ongoing. But Monica, I'd probably want to suggest something in addition to the pandemic. And that is, I think that Gladys Berejiklian was very clever at spinning what had actually taken place last October. And I say that because I think she was very clever in propagating this idea that she had a bad boyfriend, she was unlucky in love, and that won her a lot of sympathy with radio shock jocks and some newspaper gossip columnists.
And so she
took control of the narrative very quickly. So it wasn't about potential corruption or probity lapses. It was about her failed love life. And she leaned into that very shrewdly, very calculatingly. And I think that that won her some support with the public, who turned a blind eye to these probity failures.
Sorry, go on, Lucy.
Oh, I was just going to add to that, Monica, that I think further to what Troy has said there is that, you know, perhaps this time around, I think, you know, part two of this saga is the shock value of that sort of the relationship, if you will, and the love story that was that she, you know, put up as being behind this. I think the shock value of that will have subsided, and that the focus will be very much now on what that relationship meant. Did it achieve, or lead to wrongdoing, and how did it play out, I suppose, in terms of how she may or may not have used her position of office, or whether she breached public trust, you know, as a result of that relationship.
So do both of you think then that when these hearings take place, I think around October 18, likely to be highly viewed by a lot of people, including, you know, ordinary members of the public, do you think that that, you know, kind of St. Gladys aura might subside then, which is not to preempt what the hearings might unveil, of course, but just the sight of seeing Gladys Berejiklian being interrogated in the witness stand with allegations like these being put to her in presumably more detail than they were last year, do you think that that will impact her public image?
Yeah, look, I do 100%, Monica. I think that when voters look at her sitting in the witness box and being asked these additional questions, and keep in mind that ICAC usually asks questions they already know the answer to. That is the model. And they've been doing this investigation for a long time. I mean, I was hearing from Liberal MPs as early as January this year that there had been so-called secret sessions going on. People had been interviewed. And that this was very much a live and ongoing matter. And I think people will now start to probably focus a little bit better on what has actually taken place at ICAC and look at the questions being asked, the evidence produced, and her responses. But I must just flag something else, Monica, which is I've been disappointed with the quality of some of the commentary that has been in the media. I think the Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian and the Financial Review have done a good job in terms of their actual political reporters who have been following this matter, and I don't have any criticism of them, but it's the other commentators writing in newspapers and on television and radio who have come in and criticised ICAC, said that they're surprised by the resignation, it was a witch hunt, it was a star chamber, how can they do this? I mean, I saw the Channel 9 bulletin on Friday night, Monica, and that opened with a statement that the nation was grieving. Now, that is absurd. That is absurd. It's absurd reporting and absurd commentary by people who really don't know what has gone on or how ICAC operates. And I'm a little bit hot under the collar because it's frankly driving me absolutely bonkers, some of the commentary I've seen in the recent week.
And yeah, Troy, I'm sure, Troy, you would have been outraged to see some of the other comparisons, which I saw on Twitter saying, you know, it was akin to the death of Diana, and others that said it was somewhat like, you know, it reminded them of the gunning down of JFK.
I know, and again, Gladys Berejiklian has lent into that and fostered that. So, you know, we've seen her on TV, you know, collecting the flowers, accepting the well wishes, the cards that have been left outside her home and her office. I mean, the nation's gone crazy here, and I'm really concerned about the quality of political commentary in this country, that we can allow this to fester and become what many people believe is the truth when it actually is not the truth. And she is already facing significant allegations. I think some of these things are actually facts about how she has breached the ICAC Act. And so this is actually damaging for our democracy. That we're giving her essentially a free pass, and there's somehow sympathy for someone who could be facing serious implications and possible charges for corrupt conduct.
So, okay, I mean, except all of that, have we seen anything like this before in Australian political life, Troy?
I actually can't think of anything else.
77,000 signatures on a change.org petition saying she should be reinstated. Has that ever happened before? I mean, not a change.org petition, but this kind of outpouring of grief and outrage. This has happened.
I can't recall anything like it, Monica. I've racked my brain trying to think of a historical comparison. I can't think of one, but it's probably worth just briefly noting that, you know, her failure to disclose this relationship with Darryl Maguire is actually a breach of the Ministerial Code of Conduct, which sits under the ICAC Act as a regulation. So this is not an allegation. This is not an argument. This is a fact. She did not disclose what was a close, intimate, personal relationship as required by law. That, I think, is enough to warrant her resignation. But she also did not disclose a potential conflict of interest to the cabinet when she knew about his business deals. We've heard the phone taps. She heard him talk about the money he was going to make. She met his partners, his business partners. She met his clients. She received emails from his clients and partners. That is a clear conflict of interest, given that he had a business interest in the Second Sydney Airport, which the cabinet was discussing and making decisions about. And of course, the third thing is that under the ICAC Act, anyone who suspects corrupt conduct or knows of corrupt conduct has a duty to report it. So there's some very clear things where I think she has failed, yet it doesn't seem to have registered with the public at all.
Lucy, can you see any comparisons to the treatment of politicians in times gone by? You know, Gough Whitlam comes to mind. There was an outpouring of grief then. Is this comparable?
Look, I don't think it quite is. I mean, what's been quite extraordinary for me has been the fact that because she's worn this halo for so long, you know, no one had a problem with ICAC or its powers or what it was doing when it was exposing Maguire himself, you know, and some of the allegations against him or the likes of Eddie Obeid. You know, everyone couldn't do enough to sing its praises. It's only now that it is Gladys who is in their sights. I feel that has, you know, the dial has shifted. And I think it's interesting to consider, perhaps, I wonder if we hadn't been in a pandemic, if we hadn't been in this situation and her popularity wasn't such, you know, as a result of the pandemic, I wonder if the public reaction would have been quite the same, because she did not have the same public recognition pre-pandemic. You know, she became Gladys, you know, by just the singular name. She could be only known as Gladys, and she had such popularity all around Australia, and everybody knew her as a result of the pandemic. Would the support be the same without that having happened? I don't know.
Well, I mean, that does take me to a point that I wanted to raise with both of you, and that is that the pandemic seems to have created these various cults of personality around our leaders. Dan Andrews, of course, comes to mind there as well. Do you think that the pandemic has altered our relationship with the premiers and the territory leaders? Or is that kind of support that we're seeing around them a sign of something, you know, more partisan or perhaps even a bit more base creeping into our public discourse? Troy?
Yeah, I think we have seen a shift back to premier power, probably for the first time since the 1930s, and we've become a little bit parochial as well within our states. Mm. And I think at a time of crisis, at a time of challenge, people often look to authority figures, and in this case, the premiers, who seem to be on their side, doing what they can, dealing with a difficult matter, and so people seek reassurance, they seek leadership. And they're founded in the premiers. And the premiers, I think, have successfully ganged up on Scott Morrison, who, of course, has his own failures in the pandemic, and I'm not exempting those. But it's sort of set up a bit of a dichotomy between sort of state-based boundaries against the kind of national political system. So we have seen that. And I think the daily press conferences have created this sort of individual, singularly leadership-type figure. Who is responsible for everything and taking the action and being tough. So, yeah, that's been That's, I think, been a factor of the pandemic. But related to that, Monica, is also, I think, this idea that because we're in a pandemic, we need to just pause everything else. And there have been a number of commentators, and including some lawyers, have argued that, you know, this is a pandemic, it's a serious time. Maybe we just need to put this corruption hearing aside for a little while and just think about that later. Well, I think that is a ludicrous statement. We can't just sort of pause investigations into integrity and probity. In fact, they're probably more important during a pandemic than not. But we seem to have kind of lost our collective senses with some of this stuff. And the willingness to give Gladys Berejiklian a pass for what I think are serious failures is just mind-boggling. And the pandemic itself has probably a big part to do with that.
Just back to this point of the change in dynamics of power, though, which I think is a really it's an interesting phenomenon. And I wonder, Lucy, to what extent you think the media has exacerbated that issue and played into it. I mean, for example, ABC 24 has literally been taken over by press conferences, you know, from morning till night. It's extraordinary that every leader, you know, gets unlimited time to rabbit on. There was a time when Dan Andrews would get on his feet and talk for 2-3 hours, and it was all covered. Has that played into it?
Yes, I think so, because I think what it's done for the first time is it's for the public, people who have never seen a press conference in their life are suddenly watching them every single day, and you know, it's part of their daily schedule. And it gives them, I think, just sort of speaking to even my friends and family who aren't in the media, they say, you know, it sort of gives them feel like they have an inside look as to how their premier is out there fighting for them. And I think that's been particularly relevant with really contentious issues like the border wars. You know, people are sitting at home, unable to visit family in Queensland or in Western Australia and cut off for this entire pandemic. They are able to tune in and hear how their premier is fighting for them, and it's their battle. And I think it comes a little bit back to that kind of parochialism I think Troy mentioned. I do agree that has really been borne out at this time. But I think the 11 a.m. press conferences, if you will, you know, I think there's been nothing healthy, I don't think, about us all sitting down to sit and hear daily case numbers and daily death tolls. However, I think there was a lot of shock around the Premier when she announced, if we recall, when she sort of alluded the former Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, when she said she would be stepping away from doing that and pulling back. And it was that really showed the relevance of those daily press conferences, I think, for people, because there was a public outcry. People did go, well, hang on, is this the right time to be doing this? Are we opening up? And now, you know, as recently as yesterday, new Premier Dominic Perrottet has said that the 11 a.m. is going to be scrapped. The case numbers are going to be released every morning now much earlier, and we're moving ahead. We're very much in that recovery phase. So, you know, I suppose he's really trying to put his mark on the roadmap out of lockdown, and to say that he's moving away from that world in which we sit down and consume these you know, long-running press conferences.
Is that a good thing? Do you think it's a good move?
Well, I think we're moving into a Parliament's returning. You know, Parliament will resume again next week. And I think that's been one of the reasons the daily press conferences have been so important, because actually all of this year and all of this pandemic, the lockdown, at least in the last 3 months, it's been the only vehicle or the only way to hold the government to account, to put questions to them. I mean, this was the only way that you know, any of the decisions, critical key decisions they were making could be scrutinised. And that public scrutiny, I think, was really important. As we sort of move into this next stage, and we have vaccination rates where they are, and Parliament is resuming, I think there is something realistic about moving away from do we need to stand up for an hour and ask the same questions each day? I think that the dial has shifted, I suppose, with those high vaccination rates and with, you know, with life returning to some modicum of normal.
Okay, can I take you both back briefly now to ICAC for a moment and the reaction that we've seen in some quarters, and it's been across the board in media terms. I mean, at The Australian, there was a big Shari Markson piece that was quite condemnatory of the move. The Sydney Morning Herald has run its fair share of commentary pieces as well. And the general tone seems to be this is a kangaroo court, that we keep on losing premiers to this body, it's got to stop. If you link that back to federal politics for a moment, many have been, you know, lamenting the lack of ministerial accountability and the general disdain for the most basic of public standards. Do you think that the reaction that a premier has gone in this way is also a sign that we've kind of collectively forgotten what accountability means and what it is to see true leadership? Troy?
Yeah, look, there of course has been this debate at the federal level about whether there should be an integrity commission, an anti-corruption commission established, and the government has said they would do one, but probably not as strong as what Labor would do. And given the response to Gladys Berejiklian, I think there's going to be some support for that, to actually have a serious look at what kind of anti-corruption commission should be established at the federal level. I don't think there's any doubt that there should be one. But there are very, very different models across the nation. I mean, every state and territory has some kind of anti-corruption body, but they operate extremely differently. And ICAC was the first, and it does have this sort of open model where hearings are public, and the voters get to the idea about it is that voters actually get to follow what's going on and follow the presentation of evidence and follow the line of questioning in the hope that they better understand it. But that actually hasn't happened in this case at all. People, in fact, have tuned out and have been shocked by Gladys Berejiklian's resignation, even though they actually hadn't come down with any finding yet. But yes, there is going to be a continual push, I think, from Labor at the federal level for a commission of some kind. But exactly what model it is, I don't know that we've actually settled in a position nationally about what is actually best. So this is going to be something, I think, to watch in the lead up to the election.
So, Troy, do you think that the ICAC model needs a little rethink, even as it applies to New South Wales?
Well, look, I have some reservations about the ICAC model, but I'm not sure. I'm not actually sure about which is the best way to go. I mean, I'd actually like to see a public debate. I'd like to see some alternative models put forward, particularly at the national level, with some detail before I pass judgment on that. But my concern about Gladys Berejiklian was not so much the model, it was the fact that it had already uncovered that she had kept this relationship secret. And as I argue, that had meant that she had already fallen foul of the Ministerial Code of Conduct, which is a regulation that sits under the ICAC Act. And of course, she hadn't disclosed that relationship and a potential conflict of interest to the Cabinet. So the fact that it discovered these things without actually making any findings, I think were cause enough for her to resign, which has actually got nothing to do with the ICAC model, so to speak, because we haven't actually seen where this investigation has gone. But the problem for ICAC is that, let's be honest, I mean, it has had some high-profile failures. It's made some allegations about people that have been overturned in the Supreme Court, most notably Nick Greiner, the Premier, ironically, who set up ICAC in 1988. So ICAC has had some hits and misses. But in terms of Gladys Berejiklian, I think it's a slam dunk that she has breached the act.
Lucy, is ICAC doing the job that we need it to be doing?
This is going to be, I think, such a hot topic going forward now, especially as this inquiry kicks off on October 18. What we did hear a lot of in the days following Gladys Berejiklian's resignation, you know, from those supporters of hers who were highly critical of the ICAC statement, people like Philip Ruddock, and also, you know, even Health Minister Brad Hazzard made similar comments earlier this week, which was to say that there needs to be some sort of a review or overhaul or change to the way that ICAC is structured. And both of them sort of cited the Hong Kong model, and what they have in Hong Kong is a model in which it remains all behind closed doors until basically a point at which charges can be laid, I understand. So basically arguing that the sorts of things that we've seen to date and the sorts of allegations, you know, that were laid out in in a statement released by ICAC last week. That shouldn't have been made public perhaps until now, which and that therefore challenges exactly what we're talking about here, and which is, you know, the right of the voter and the public to sit and to watch these inquiries as they play out. And I think that also, I don't know, I sort of feel a bit uncomfortable with that idea as well, in the sense that, you know, yes, ICAC has its issues with, you know, people who do go and appear as witnesses often get tarnished with the brush of appearing at ICAC, and that can be a problem for them, and I understand that. But by the same token, I also think ICAC hasn't just woken up and written a statement and emailed it out and said, these are the things we've decided to look at. These are allegations and points of investigation that are the product of many, many, many months of inquiry. And as everybody says, ICAC asks questions they already know the answers to. We are going to, I imagine, see hear and see a litany of evidence at this inquiry, and we will hear phone recordings, perhaps we will see documents tendered. So they do come out with these statements and these inquiries off the back of investigation. So I don't think it's necessarily, it's not happening in a vacuum and out of the blue, as it were.
But you're saying that that's a damaging bit, that that's what should stop or be changed?
No, I'm not saying that at all. This is what we've seen a lot of in the discourse. I agree. I don't know necessarily what, I don't know enough yet to say probably how the model should be tweaked, but some of the arguments, I suppose, from Gladys Berejiklian's supporters in the last week have been that it shouldn't have been as public as it has been to date, and that maybe we should be looking at models overseas, similar to Hong Kong, where things stay behind closed doors for longer.
Okay. Now, before I let you both go, I just want to turn your minds briefly to Gladys Berejiklian's replacement, Dominic Perrottet. There's been an awful lot of focus on his religious beliefs. A politician's personal beliefs, of course, do meet some level of the public interest discourse. But in the case of a figure like Perrottet, many of us know very, very little about him. Were either of you uncomfortable with the level of scrutiny and distrust expressed in the media, and sometimes by members of the media, and certainly on social media, into his religious beliefs, Troy?
Yes, it's a good question, Monica. I've actually been appalled by some of the questioning and some of the focus on his personal beliefs. When he was interviewed on the New South Wales ABC news bulletin the day he became premier, the first question was about his religion. Mm. Now, I mean, these are personal beliefs. He is a conservative Catholic. That's his prerogative. I'm not aware that his conservative social views have acted on his public responsibilities in terms of actual decisions being made.
But they could.
But he is a part of a very socially progressive, moderate Liberal government, and it should be judged on its policies rather than the individual beliefs of ministers. I think he also is someone who has traditionally been very pragmatic and very shrewd, and I think that those on the left. And I mean, not so much journalists, but the Labor Party should be very, very careful about going after somebody's personal views, because there's a lot of socially conservative Labor voters or swinging voters who would be unsettled by that kind of line of questioning. Let's judge him on what he actually does and whether or not his personal beliefs impact on actual decision making. I've seen no evidence yet that it does. And in fact, you know, the other argument could be put for someone who might be an atheist or an agnostic. I mean, someone might say, don't we need Christian values in public life? But we never hear that kind of questioning. So let's just judge him on what he does rather than what he believes in his private life.
Lucy, isn't the entire point of a liberal democracy to show some, you know, tolerance towards personal belief? Do you think the media got the balance right in the coverage of Perrottet's ascendancy to the premiership?
I think there was a lot of focus on it, I suppose, and I guess it sort of it came off the back. I think people really targeted the fact of his voting record on the, you know, the abortion bill, which we saw in 2019, and to, you know, he voted against removing that from the criminal code. And that was a conscience vote that was held. He's defended his decision and his faith and said, you know, he's very proud of his faith and that, you know, diversity should be celebrated, I think he said in his first press conference, and not criticized. And, you know, he should be judged on who he is and what he says, not simply on his religion. I think what he was really trying to do is on Tuesday, at least, was to point out that he would always be committed to, despite his faith, he would always be committed to conscience votes on social issues. And that will definitely play a big role in coming weeks and months over voluntary assisted dying, which we know is going to come before the parliament. And, you know, there's a lot of talk that that was sort of one of the conditions of getting the moderate support in the party for his tilt at the leadership, which was that he would give a conscience vote on that issue. So I think I was surprised with some of the, you know, we have seen a lot of coverage on his faith. I think I wasn't entirely surprised at the outpouring of you know, anger in many corners of Twitter and social media, I guess, because yeah. I suppose I sort of feel like that was the obvious line that would be followed and picked up on.
Yep. Okay, then a final question to you both. The next New South Wales state election isn't due until, I think, March 2023. So the next election of consequence is the federal election. Without Gladys Berejiklian around, do you think that Scott Morrison faces an uphill battle in New South Wales, Troy?
Yeah, I do. I think she was somewhat of a defender of his against the Labor premiers in Queensland and Western Australia and Victoria. So he's lost an ally, I think, in the National Cabinet, someone who's, you know, more sort of open to relaxing restrictions and getting, you know, the state opened up again as fast as possible, getting kids back to school, getting businesses up and running again. So he's lost an ally there, and New South Wales is going to be very challenging, I think, for the coalition. But at the end of the day, I think the voters, come the federal election, will judge the government on its record, and on Labor, on its plans and on its policies, and also the two leaders. I think, you know, leadership has always been important, particularly in federal elections. And given this pandemic, I think that's going to be even more so. Voters will be looking very clearly at Scott Morrison and Anthony Albanese and making an almost presidential choice, I think, when it comes to the next election.
And Lucy, what do you think? Do you think that if, say, for example, Perrottet stumbles along the way of taking New South Wales out of lockdown, that that will have a federal impact?
Look, as we know, New South Wales is the biggest state. I think this has been the line of the new Perrottet government, which is that if New South Wales does well, the rest of Australia does well. So ergo, in the reverse, the same could be true. I think, you know, the two have obviously had a prickly relationship at times, but constructive. I think the way that Perrottet described it this week was to say that his meetings and dealings with Scott Morrison and within the National Cabinet, it's not a kumbaya session. He's there to fight for New South Wales, but also, you know, work constructively. So I think New South Wales' success under this new Perrottet government is going to be critical for Scott Morrison. But I think also at the end of the day, people are going to be, when it comes to the federal election, I think people are going to be thinking about vaccine rollouts and vaccine supply and the way the federal government handled that. And I think people understand that that was a federal issue as opposed to something handled by the state government. And I think that anger maybe that remains around the rollout and how things were handled in that regard will play a big role for people when it comes to the ballot box.
Okay, and on that note, I'll let you both go. I thank you both for a fantastic discussion. It was super interesting, and I hope we can get you back on the program again soon.
Thanks so much, Monica.
And on that note, I'd like to thank Lucy Cormack and Troy Bramston for being on For the State, and thank you for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. For the State is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to For the State on your favourite podcast app so that you can hear us talk media and politics and everything in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle there is FourthEstateAU. Thanks to my producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Monica Attard, and thank you for listening.